A whole gang of media snoopers, including Jonathan Marks, scans from D.C. to daylight every Thursday here on Radio Netherlands. Their super-duper whopper-doppler receiver gizmos pick out the essence of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting. Radio Netherlands, we have the technology.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
It's Thursday, November 3rd, 1983, today.
Hello, this is Media Network Room Radio in Florence.
By shortwave and satellite from Geneva.
Media Network, the weekly communications magazine for shortwave listeners. Produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Hello from PAL Expo, the huge exhibition hall on the outskirts of Geneva, Switzerland, where workmen are now ripping apart millions of dollars worth of exhibition stands. 2 days ago, the doors closed on the largest telecommunications exhibition of its kind as part of UN World Communications Year. It was called Telecom 83, and it seems some 193,000 visitors packed into Geneva during this past week that it was open. The size and the cost of such an event really has to be seen to be believed. One multinational company told me their stand cost over $4 million to construct, man, and now dismantle. You might at first dismiss such an exhibition as too specialist and not much interest to you and I. After all, not many people are in the market for a new telephone exchange or a satellite network. But what's been fascinating over the last few days is to see how more and more of industrial technology will have a direct bearing on our lives very shortly. Today and over the next few weeks, we'll be looking at some of the aspects in detail. But we start today with events in America and the Caribbean. A week ago yesterday, October 26th, fire destroyed the medium and shortwave transmitters of the Voice of the Suriname Revolution, the SRS in Paramaribo. An organization claiming to oppose the present Bautista regime has claimed responsibility. Only the VHF transmitter was left intact. Radio has also played its part in another political operation, as Dennis Powell reports now from New York.
The story of the invasion of Grenada is one that was told almost exclusively by radio. When the invasion began, it was told by tiny Radio Free Grenada, which nevertheless kept to its format, complete with music and even morning time checks.
11 minutes before 7, United States paratroopers have invaded Grenada with helicopter gunships. All Grenadians are asked to come out and defend our country. All Grenadians are asked to report.
It had been Radio Free Grenada which early this year announced each afternoon that an invasion of the island by the United States was imminent. It quoted Prime Minister Maurice Bishop as saying so.
You're listening to the news which is coming to you from the studios of Radio Free Grenada. The revolutionary government of Grenada has accused the Associated States of attempting to sabotage the Bishop government.
But Bishop had been dead for 6 days when on October 25th the long-awaited invasion arrived. Reports were sketchy at first, with the announcement by Radio Free Grenada giving the first indication that foreign soldiers had landed.
The Revolutionary Military Council is calling on all friendly, peace-loving countries to condemn this act of aggression and immediately come to Grenada's aid. Because at 5:40 this morning, foreign troops began landing in Grenada.
Most American broadcasters presumed that there would be no phone service to the island, but using the World Radio TV Handbook to get a phone number, Art Blazer of the RKO Radio Networks decided to try to reach the studios of Radio Free Grenada. He succeeded. A woman there screamed, "The U.S. is invading Grenada! The U.S. is invading Grenada!" And then she slammed down the phone. When the phone went dead, so did the last outside contact with the station, and except for amateur radio, the last outside civilian contact with the island at all. When the Bishop regime took power in 1979, one of the first things it did was to seize amateur radio equipment. But in the 4 years since, ham radios had reappeared, and it was a good thing, too. The American amateur services were quick to make communications available. Steve Mendelson, associated with the American Radio Relay League, was of huge help in gathering information. He contacted Don Atkinson, an American ham from Connecticut, who happened to be spending the autumn in Grenada. The information Atkinson had was the very first out of the island following the invasion.
Well, the first thing we observed observed where four engine Orion type aircraft been passing over this immediate area. I have not seen those, so I can't identify them. Yourself?
QSL, Don. Did the jets drop any bombs? Were there any bombers involved, or were they strictly high-flying recon types? Go ahead.
I have observed no dropping of bombs anywhere as yet, but there has been a gunship kind of fired towards the ground. Yourself?
How about ground action? Is there anywhere where the ground action seems to be heavily concentrated?
Came in at the brand new airport area, and obviously there was some ground action at that point.
By the second day of the invasion, the Grenadian power station had been captured and apparently shut down. Power, at any rate, was greatly reduced, and transmissions from the island consisted of very weak, intermittent signals from a Grenadian national with a battery-powered set and the small amateur station at the St. George's Medical School, which had an emergency transmitter and only 8 hours of fuel. Still, the information from the island got through due to the monitoring by various hams and by the American Radio Relay League offices in Newington, Connecticut. Hal Steinman of the ARRL told reporters what was being transmitted, and even the exciting story of how a ham operator had helped to arrange the rescue of students at the school and to reassure those terrified students.
One of the hams back in the States contacted the State Department, and the State Department sent the message back that we are aware of your situation and help is on the way. And they were instructed to prepare for evacuation and pack, and then they were allowed 50 pounds each. And they are currently still awaiting evacuation.
There's still considerable discussion and much criticism of the American action in occupying the island of Grenada, but there surely can be no doubt that without the use of radio, the whole situation would have been far more ominous, especially to the families of the people on Grenada.
And that's the news tonight. I'm Paul Roberts reporting.
This has been news.
Well, NBC television news reports on Saturday, October 29th, seem to indicate that the studios of Radio Free Grenada have now been destroyed. Though the state of the medium and shortwave transmitters isn't known, that was somewhere else. They're not on the air, though.
This is Radio Netherlands, the Dutch international service.
That voice and the ones at the start of today's program were generated by computers from three different companies, all of whom feel the development of a machine that can speak like a human is going to be rather important in telecommunications. You just heard the voice from a computer from the US concern AT&T, who showed a research model here at Telecom 83. It seemed to have great problems saying the word Netherlands. More developed seemed to be a system from Digital Equipment Corporation, and Leland Katz, their media programs manager, has joined me now in our makeshift studio to escape the noise of those workmen outside. Leland, there have been speaking clocks on the market for years, so what's so special about your system, DECTALK?
All right. Well, speaking clocks and other kinds of voice synthesis generally take pre-recorded programs, something that's already been stored, and then simply plays that back. This device is capable of taking what is called ASCII text, that is, text which is typed into a computer, and translating that directly and immediately into human language, into audible human language.
Now, can you connect this unit to an ordinary personal computer?
Yes, directly to an ordinary personal computer. The unit itself simply does the translation of the text into the human language. We generally believe that the first and perhaps most important commercial application will be for people who have electronic mail systems in their companies but who are away from the office and who don't have access to a terminal. In that case, they can get access directly to their electronic mail system through any ordinary touch-tone type telephone and have their mail, instead of looking at it on a tube or having it printed out on a printer, can hear it read to them, in effect, over the telephone by the voice synthesizer.
What about the visually handicapped?
I don't know that we have actually looked into that as a market. However, it is perfectly plausible and totally possible within the technology to have, for example, a book which has been typeset using computer typesetting techniques, to have those typeset commands translated through the DECTALK system into voice for the visually handicapped. Most newspapers, not only in the United States but around the world, are now produced using computerized typesetting. That is also possible to capture that information electronically, feed it through the DECTALK, and have people have a daily newspaper available to them. That's not to say that that's going to happen tomorrow, but it is technologically feasible.
What about languages? Because I noticed the demonstration is in English. Does it mean that it doesn't yet work in other languages?
That's not a function of the technology. That's a function of the intelligence of the programmers behind it and how much effort has been put into developing the various languages. We started with the development in the United States, so it was natural that English would be the first language. Other languages will take some time because it does indeed take quite a bit of human effort in order to put the various sounds into the computer properly so that it can then repeat those sounds accurately and be understood by the person who speaks that language.
And you're not just stuck with one particular voice, I notice.
No, the particular demonstration that we have here at Telecom 83 has seven voices in it, and those are programmable. Not only that, but the system is capable of changing the speed of the voice from a very slow 120 words per minute up to an extremely fast 300 words per minute.
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers. She sells seashells on the seashore. As you will have noticed, that was spoken very slowly. No, I'll say them at my fastest rate, which is 300 words per minute. Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers. She sells seashells on the seashore.
We also have built into the system the capability of doing voice inflections so that a question mark at the end of a sentence will cause the voice to raise its inflection at the end of the sentence as opposed to dropping it, which gives it a more natural human feeling and is more friendly, if you will, to the person who's listening to it.
It can also sing.
The night, exchanging glances, lovers at first sight, they knew the chances, it turned out so bright, for strangers in the night, doo-be-doo-be-doo.
That, however, as I understand from our engineers, takes a great deal of programming effort in order to get the appropriate tones and inflections and pace for the song into the system. However, it's not so difficult that we couldn't do it for a demonstration here in a trade show environment.
So finally, how much is this unit going to cost?
That I can't tell you as yet. It is a product which is in development. The system we have here is a prototype. It has not yet been formally announced as a product. However, it has been publicly shown. We expect to announce it as a product in the near-term future, and the price will be announced at that time. I would expect that it would be within the next 6 to 9 months. I don't know precisely.
Well, the computer world also doesn't know precisely what's happening next. You may have heard that Texas Instruments have just decided to give up in the field of personal computers. Other companies like Osborne and New Brain have fallen into financial crises, whilst 2 days ago, IBM launched their anticipated personal computer, the PCJR, for a price of $669. Its success or otherwise will be watched with interest. Meanwhile, in Sweden, the telecommunications authority there have announced a speech synthesizer which can speak more languages.
This is a demonstration of how synthesized speech can help the handicapped. It works like this.
You may remember we mentioned that Gothenburg Radio recently started tests of a digital-to-speech converter in conjunction with a local newspaper and Radio Gothenburg. Well, that black box has been on display here in Geneva, and with me now is Gunnar Fagerberg from the Swedish Institute for the Handicapped. You say it can speak more than just English.
Yes, this system now is capable of some 7 or 8 languages, has the pronunciation rules. Those languages are English, French, German, Swedish, Italian, Spanish. We're working on Danish and Hungarian, and it also has a little Chinese, actually.
Now, the system itself consists of a box with a loudspeaker on the front. And can you use an ordinary home computer with this?
Yes, the system will take any digital input of the standard kind, which could be provided from a home computer or a big computer or just a very simple keyboard.
And how much does the unit cost?
At present, it costs a little less than $2,500. By next year, it will be around 2,000.
And who are your main customers?
Well, at present, the first production series is almost entirely used by disabled people, actually. Some are used by speech handicapped people, people who cannot speak themselves, and some are used by blind people.
Media Network, the weekly communications magazine for shortwave listeners.
Media Network's Book Review.
Part of Telecom 83 has been out in the damp Geneva open air, most of it devoted to a display of the various types of satellite dishes now available to make use of communication networks. Perhaps you regard satellites as a bit boring. They're up there, they carry thousands of telephone calls, but so what? Well, like computers, which have found their way into the home, pioneered by amateurs with extra pocket money, satellite television seems to be doing the same. The hobby has increased fivefold this year in North America, and Telecom 83 has seen the launch of a new publication designed to explain how the amateur can get involved. It's called the Satellite TV Handbook, and its American author, Anthony T. Easton, is with me now. Reading the electronic press, Anthony, it would appear that many people are rather upset that you're able to tap what are essentially point-to-point communication satellites above the United States. So isn't the whole hobby illegal?
Well, good question, because in fact there are two kinds of people feeding video feeds domestically in the United States. There are the people whose television programs are sponsored with commercials, such as Ted Turner's Cable News Network, and they, of course, like you to watch their feeds. Then there are people like the commercial pay TV organizations, like Home Box Office, who operate pay movie services, and they look askance at you viewing, although it is not illegal to do that at present. So their solution, of course, is to go to a higher level of technology and to scramble. And when they do that, we fully expect large numbers of people will buy scramblers and pay them the monthly fee of $5 or $7 to watch the pay movie services.
But at the moment, they're not scrambled.
No, not presently. And so essentially, if you buy a dish, you can watch not only the commercially supported, but also the pay movie services for free in the United States.
But hang on, you say buy a dish. I mean, if you buy a dish which is working at 4 gigahertz, 3 to 4 gigahertz, plug it in the back of your UHF or VHF television, you're not going to get any results. You need something to go in between.
Ah, yes. You need, in addition to the dish, in fact, which is simply a piece of metal, usually in a parabolic shape, let's say 3 to 4 meters in size, the dish is simply a collector which focuses the rather weak radiation. You realize, of course, that these darn things are 22,300 miles away, and they're only putting out a 5-watt signal. That's about the power output of one of these little Christmas tree light bulbs. So the output of this dish, it feeds into a low-noise amplifier, somewhat like a preamplifier you would find on a turntable of a modern hi-fi system, and that amplifies the signal up, and it's fed into a satellite receiver, which converts the 3.5-4 gigahertz signal into a conventional television signal that can be received over your UHF receiver.
Can you buy this or actually make it yourself?
You can build them as well, and in fact, in my book, I give information, two chapters, on constructing your own backyard dish for $200 and building your own receiver for $300. You have to be competent, of course, as a hobbyist in electronics. But the prices have fallen, you know, so quickly in the States that for $1,000 to $2,000, you can really walk away with quite an adequate system, which will give you at least 50 different video feeds.
Right. You're talking about the United States. Does what you're saying apply to other parts of the world as well? Because if the satellite's below the horizon, you're not going to be able to pick it up.
It's a good question. In the United States, of course, we have, in Canada as well, I should point out, have built many domestic C-band satellites which are operated. There are not too many operating in other parts of the world. In the world, however, there are two other types of satellite systems in addition, of course, to the domestic U.S. systems. There is Intelsat, the international satellite consortium of over 100 countries, which operates the global telecommunications network. And then there is the Russian Intersputnik system. Both of these satellite systems require, unfortunately, much larger dishes, on the order of 5.5 to 7 meters. But with a 6-meter dish in Europe, you can watch oodles of satellite programming.
Okay, in 440 pages, you've got 14 chapters explaining not only the background to why these satellites are up, where exactly they are, their frequencies, but also an extensive appendix giving sources of further information, manufacturers, groups interested in this sort of thing, and a glossary of the jargon. But is it really going to interest somebody in Asia, say, even if you can't afford to build a dish yourself?
Yes, and interestingly enough, Asia probably is as advanced, if not more advanced, than other parts of the world in this area. For example, there is presently in operation throughout the Far East a C-band network shared by a number of countries, and it, of course, is the domestic satellite network of Indonesia. In addition, the Japanese have been operating a series of experimental broadcast satellites and are constructing their own, as well as the Australians. So if you are an Asian potential satellite television viewer, as it were, there are a fair number of choices you have, as well as the American feeds, which you can pick up through the Intelsat satellites, which, of course, require a much larger dish.
We've been talking about television so far. What about just audio? And in fact, isn't this a sort of market for international broadcasting stations? Kick out the shortwave and go to satellite.
Yeah, very much so. I would not be at all surprised to see a number of the international shortwave radio organization taking its signals to the satellites shortly. This would be, for example, very easy to do to feed North America and South America by relaying the audio feeds through one of the subcarriers of the American domestic satellites. You need, of course, indeed, another receiver. The way it works as follows. You tune to that particular satellite. First, you locate it in space. It doesn't move, so once you've pointed your dish at it, it will be there forever as long as it's operating. That's 7 years in this business, and that's forever. That's about as long as you can expect. The output of your satellite receiver is a 6 megahertz video spectrum bandwidth. You then feed that channel into a general-purpose tunable communications receiver. You physically take the output of your video signal into the front-end antenna of your communications receiver, and then you tune up and down the spectrum with your communications receiver.
Well, shortwave radio.
That's right, exactly. It depends on the spectrums and on the formats used, but the telephone channels are every 4,000 hertz apart, and the high-frequency, wideband, high-fidelity channels are 20,000 or more.
So there's still a use for your shortwave radio if and when people decide to go to satellite. I would tend to stress your point about technical knowledge being required, though, before you can build a satellite receiver yourself, and also the need for larger dishes in Europe. In fact, if you wanted to get something going, say, here in Geneva, how much would it cost?
Well, in Europe, if you wish to look at satellites, you're looking to spend about $2,000 to $2,500 if you're pretty capable at working out these things. And if you want to buy an off-the-shelf system from a dealer, you could double that.
Well, the Satellite Television Handbook by Anthony T. Easton is published by Howard Sams and Company at $16.95 in the United States. If you live outside the USA, an airmailed copy of the book, plus other related documents, will cost you 25 United States dollars from this address. The Satellite Center, P.O. Box 33045, San Francisco, California, and the zip code 94133 USA. The Satellite Center, Box 33045, San Francisco, California, 94133 USA. You can also get a pamphlet explaining the contents more thoroughly for 2 international reply coupons from the same address. And with the news that Satellite TV, based in London, has finally been given the go-ahead to broadcast to cable companies in the United Kingdom, things in this particular field are expected to move fast.
I watched it for a little while. I love to watch things on TV. Satellite of love. Satellite of love.
Well, that's not a record I specially selected to go with that last item, but just taken off the radio before we went on the air. France is literally a few miles away from where I'm sitting, and on that side of the border, a number of private commercial stations are beaming VHF FM programs into Geneva. Let's scan the band.
Radio Pays de Gex sur 103,7 MHz en modulation de fréquence et en stéréo.
103,7 Radio Pays de Gex.
What's new in disco?
Vous êtes toujours à l'écoute d'Amplitude Bleue 103.2 FM stéréo.
C'est trop facile de dire je t'aime. C'est trop commun de dire je t'aime.
Et bonjour à tous et bonjour à toutes. C'est Amplitude Réveil qui commence.
The technical quality of the stations ranges from excellent to totally distorted, and there's a heavy bias towards French language rock music. But on 99 MHz, you'll find relays of BBC World Service and Voice of America at some points in the day, from a station called Radio 74. It's an English language operation mixing light music, news relays, and religion. Ron Myers is the station's manager, and he's upset at the recent French government decision that because of the lack of space on the VHF dial, groups that want a licence may have to share a frequency, each using it for part of the day.
We said, okay, now look, Radio Celeb, that is, you want the morning hours, Amplitude Blue, you insist you have to have the evening hours? They said, yes. And they said, in fact, if you don't sign with us Radio 74, we will abandon you and go with somebody else. We'll go with ELP 1 and Zone or whatever. And there you'll be sitting alone, and if you're alone, you won't get a license at all. So, in fact, Radio 74 has signed an agreement with Radio Celeb and Amplitude Blue to share a frequency. That means we're going to get, well, normally 8 hours a day of broadcast time. Because these other people wanted the very best hours, we, in fact, will only have, according to the present agreement, unless some major thing happens, Radio 74 will have 4 hours in the middle of the day, and we'll have the all-night hours, midnight to 6. But these things are all being discussed yet, and who knows what could come out of it. The final story has not been done. The decision, the final decision, will be taken, as best we can tell, in about 10 days' time in Paris. We have some other possibilities up our sleeve in the event we do get confined to only 4 hours a day, and those things will reveal to you as time goes on. That's phase two. We're still shooting for something that's reasonable here on this radio station. We're not driving around in Maseratis as the owners of some of the local radio stations who've done, advertising cachet, hidden, and some of it pretty open. We're not going to do that. We're going to play the game by the rules.
Radio 74. Radio 74.
Back on shortwave, Qatar has appeared on a new frequency, 9905 kHz, 9905, noted on Tuesday here at 16 hours UTC with a reasonable signal. And now we cross to New Zealand, where Arthur Cushion has further listening suggestions.
Latin American stations are dominant on medium and shortwave here in southern New Zealand around dusk and later in the evening. And some of the highlights include Argentina. We've noted on 6120, Radio National Buenos Aires on this frequency, identifying at 0900. The channel was formerly used by Radio El Mundo. Brazil, Radio Braz, two English transmissions, 1800 UTC on 15280 kHz, and again at 0215 on 15290, and the frequency actually in both cases is announced as 15280. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CKZN Newfoundland, operating on 6160, has been heard as late as 1000 UTC. They have a CBC News, the power is only 1000 watts, and here's a typical identification.
The time is 7:30. CBC Radio News.
That was CKZN, 6160, recorded 1000 UTC. Nicaragua, moving to medium wave, La Voz de Nicaragua, 620 kHz medium wave, has been heard identifying around 0715. There is popular music of English and Latin American variety. Peru, Radio Junta has changed frequency to 4746 kHz and has moved here from 4754 due to interference from the Brazilian on the channel. Sign-on is still 0900. on a higher frequency, 9486, we hear Radio Techna opening at 0900 with a program summary for the day. USA, the Voice of America Dixon transmitter, which has been reactivated, has been heard in Spanish between 1130 and 1400. This is the best time for reception, and the frequencies of 6040 and 9540 kHz provide good signals at sign-off at 1400 with English identification. Taiwan, the transmission's extended to Australia and New Zealand from the Voice of Free China, 0100, 0200, 0300, 0350, 2140, 2240, UTC, all in English. Frequencies are 11825, 15345, 17800 and 17890 kHz, which provides the best reception, and here is a typical sign-off announcement.
The Voice of Free China now comes to a close of its 60-minute English program from 2140 to 2240 Greenwich Mean Time.
Thanks, Arthur. And with the news that NASA announced last night that the Space Shuttle Columbia will now fly on November 28th, with, we hope, amateur radio operator and astronaut Owen Garriott on board, we'll have to
clear off.
But there's more about telecom and communications in general in next week's programme, which will come from Hilversum. For the moment, this is Jonathan Mark saying back soon. Bye for now.
I've been doing some listening between 3 and 30 megawatts. It's, some people get static, some people get far off countries. I just get a headache.
Serving the universe from Flevo, Radio Netherlands, with relays in Russia, Bonaire, and Madagascar. Any questions?
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network program. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.